Welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm great, John. How are you?
I am doing great as well. I feel very kind of happy and relieved right now because it's one of those times where I've just finished a pretty big project I've been working on for about 6 months. And you know that feeling, right? When you've been working on something for a long time, you've been going back and forth, doing a lot of pull requests, thinking a lot about the project, you know, trying to do it in the best possible way, and then it's done. It feels like, all right, this feels great.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one of the advantages of doing client work because there is such a thing as being done with client work when you finish whatever they hired you to do. And of course, the project itself is never done when we're talking about software, but your participation on it might be done. They may hire you in the future again to do some changes or whatnot. But yeah, it's one of those things where when you're doing stuff for yourself, like I do most of the time, you're never done. It's never finished. But with client work, there is such a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, what you hope for, or at least I do when I work with a client, is when I finish a project for them that they want me to do something else after that, right? And then yep. You can continue and sign up for another kind of deliverable or another project that you're doing over a couple of months. That's kind of my favorite when I can do that, when I can work with not just like new clients all the time, but work with the same people, but then, you know, different kind of longer sprints or longer projects within that application or within that kind of larger project. So that is always really neat when you can kind of combine the two. But yeah, absolutely. It's one of the things I really like about being a freelancer is that you can kind of scope out something in a pretty clear, consistent way, and then you can work on that and you can kind of deliver that. Of course, you have to be flexible as well, and people very often change their minds, and sometimes something comes up that you didn't think about, or some platform change happens or whatever, but at least you have that kind of deliverable that you're working towards, and then you deliver that, and that's kind of a nice kind of goalpost that you just reached, and then you can kind of plan for the next thing.
Yeah, definitely. And anything in particular about this project that you learned or that you noticed that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought my topic for this week would be kind of about how I'm approaching refactoring and rewriting of existing or old code, and how I'm kind of weaving that into new feature development, because I think that's something that a lot of developers are thinking about or trying to kind of come up with a good balance of how do I make sure to tackle kind of the technical depth in my project while also moving forward with new feature development. And there are so many different strategies you can take here. And one kind of approach that I've been trying to use for many, many years now, and I know that a lot of other teams like to use as well, is this idea of the scout rule, where when you're working on a particular feature, you are also trying to kind of leave it in a better place than how you found it, right? Yeah. Like you're trying to always improve the parts of the code base that you're working on, because it can very often be hard to find a time to do like dedicated refactoring or rewriting a specific kind of subsystem or a view controller or just a component. It can be hard to just find a time to just do a complete kind of refactoring or rewrite without adding any new features or adding quote unquote value to the product. Of course, when we're refactoring, if we're doing it in kind of the right way, we are adding a ton of value to the product in terms of the maintenance and in terms of the code quality and hopefully also like reducing the amount of bugs that can happen and so on. But we all know as developers that it can be hard to kind of sell that to both to clients and to also project managers and other people you work with, like to get the time to actually be able to do that, especially if it's a larger thing where it's sometimes hard to convince people to say, well, can I get 2 months just to kind of refactor this thing instead of delivering new features? That can be a kind of difficult conversation to have in many teams.
I mean, I can't even sell that idea to myself being right. My own boss. So it's going to be hard to sell it to someone else. So I take pretty much the same approach that I'm sure you're going to be describing, which is change things when you are working on that area of stuff and yeah, make things better. Because if you don't do that, there's the danger, and it often happens in real life, where you end up with a bunch of stuff just duct taped together in a code base, and things work, but any little change you do might break a bunch of stuff you don't know about. And yeah, when you reach that point, you're pretty much forced into refactoring.
Exactly. And that's kind of a point you don't want to reach. And at the same time, you don't want to be refactoring or rewriting things just for the sake of it, right? Like that's usually not a very good use of our time. And also, another thing that's important to always to keep in mind, I think, is that even if you have that piece of code that is like, quote unquote, legacy code, like older code or code that feels kind of like it's held together by duct tape and chewing gum. A lot of the times, that code has been iterated on so much and a lot of bugs have been fixed so that even if the look of the code, like it looks bad, it looks dated, or it looks fragile, it actually works in production, right? And it covers all of these different edge cases that your rewrite might not cover. And that's why we very often joke about these things that, you know, when you're rewriting something, you are replacing the bugs you knew about with bugs you didn't know about. And that's kind of what you want to avoid, right? So you want to make sure that you strike that nice balance between keeping your code up to date and keeping it like well working and well functioning, but also like focusing on progressing in the actual project and in the product itself.
Yeah.
And the scout rule that we talked about then, like that's something that a lot of people use. Like I think in general, it's a very good practice that while you're already busy working on a part of the code base, that's a good time to also kind of tweak things, make sure that things look nice, maybe add a couple of unit tests, add some documentation, maybe remove some like force unwrapped optionals or something, you know, like make that a little bit more clear, remove some potential for bugs, remove some potential for crashes and so on, like make the dependencies more clear between the different objects. That's usually like a very good time to do it because you're already touching that part of the code base, you're already working on it. And, you know, with a couple of tweaks here and there, you can actually make something much better. But at the same time, I think a lot of developers have fallen into this trap, and I know I've done that many times in the past as well. A big mistake that you can make is you start that kind of refactoring process as you're doing that feature development, and all of a sudden, this commit that you've been working on or this pull request you've been working on for this new feature just starts exploding in complexity, where you have that like, you know, 2,000, 3,000, or even more thousands lines of code for this. Maybe in the beginning it was kind of a simple change, a new feature, but because it now has all of these refactoring as well in that pull request, it just starts becoming a huge thing. And very often also we can fall into that trap of, you know, you start refactoring one thing and then you have to change the call sites that are using that particular function, for example. And then you want to change that as well because you spot something there which maybe isn't optimized or doesn't look that great. And then you change that and then you kind of move up the stack and you start changing all these different layers. And then again, all of a sudden you have like thousands of lines of changes in your Git diff, which also isn't really great.
Yeah, when we did that in the old jobby job where we had a small team, but it was a bunch of people changing the same code base, our approach, which I think I brought up because it's what I used to do, it was to do the refactoring, but if it was going to be a case where a bunch of call sites were going to have to be modified, we would shim the old API to the new API so that the existing call sites could look the same. That's not something you can do for every case if you change an API, but it was something that happened when we did that stuff because it was often places where we were making an API more Swifty because the code base was a mix of Objective-C and Swift, and some old APIs that were Objective-C didn't do nullability and things like that correctly. So it was a lot of that. But then we would create a shim that would call into the new API to reduce that noise in a pull request. And then in the future, someone else would do basically a find and replace and delete the shim.
Right. Yeah, that can be a really good approach. It's similar to what I ended up doing in this case with this 6-month project I've been working on, which did involve adding a bunch of new features and also like really changing a lot under the hood of a particular subsystem of this product, which is a quite complicated code base. Like it's a quite large code base. So if I were to do all of these changes all at once, like follow that scout rule, like just, you know, completely and just say, let me just do all of these things at the same time, then it would have been like, you know, one huge pull request that would have been almost impossible for anyone to review. So one thing that I decided as I started working on this was, what I want to do here is I either want to change the implementation of a particular class or subsystem or module, or I want to refactor and change the API, but not both at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So what I did was I started like working on different pull requests that were like over the course of these 6 months. I delivered this like as many different smaller changes. And I either in each pull request, I maybe didn't do it like completely, like strictly all the time, but I tried as much as possible to either just work on the implementation or to work on the actual API. Because like I mentioned, when you change the API, it's not just that you're changing this one function or a couple of functions. You also have to usually update all of the call sites. And especially like if you're introducing new concepts, like in this case, I was using async await. And that also means that at the call site, I would need to wrap those calls in tasks and change maybe a couple of like delegates or other kind of metaphors to now also use async await and be wary of like, is this called like on a main actor annotated class or do I have to do something around that? So, you know, you kind of end up having to bubble this complexity or bubble these changes up to in the stack. And that's why I wanted to like, if I'm changing the API, I want to do that in a separate pull request as much as possible so that I can kind of work my way towards this goal through a series of pull requests where some of them changes the implementation, some of them changes an API and updates the call sites, and some of them also just adds new features without, again, trying to change too many things at the same time. So that's, I think, my new approach to this is that I still want to follow that scout rule of like making things better as I'm working on a new feature and trying to always like tackle technical debt as part of feature development. I think that's a good thing, but I don't want to do it necessarily in the same commit or the same pull request. I want to kind of split things up so that I have different tasks that are kind of accomplishing different goals or different sub-goals of a larger goal.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. And again, we always need to mention this, but just because something is old code doesn't mean necessarily that it's bad. And famously, at the Jobby Job again, we had, I think the initial version of the app had been made back in 2012, and we had a bunch of model code that was written in Objective-C back in that time, and it was doing JSON parsing in Objective-C and had a bunch of legacy stuff in there and a bunch of checks and stuff that we didn't even know why it was there. But hey, it's been working since 2012. I think it's good. Let's leave it. So we encapsulated those models and we made facilities to like convert from those models into Swift structs and back and things like that, just to make the APIs nicer, but without risking breaking a bunch of stuff just because, oh, we want this old code gone.
Right, exactly. I think that's definitely what you want to keep in mind. And another couple of things I want to bring up here is like, for example, formatting changes, where if you discover some older part of the code base that is formatted in a way, or it's using like some code styling conventions that are not really up to par with how you're doing it in the rest of the project, I also try to avoid doing those kind of changes, especially if it's like a formatting thing on the whole file, as part of doing some feature, because I've seen that happen so many times when I'm working with different teams, and I've probably made this mistake many times in the past myself, is that you commit some kind of feature, but then you also have a ton of formatting changes in that. And then it's really hard when you're doing the pull request review to see like what's an actual change and what's just a formatting change, because those formatting changes will usually mark like maybe an entire file as modified, even though it might just be like whitespace tweaks, right? So that, yeah, I definitely want to make sure to at least do in a separate commit. But if I can, I think it's even better to do it just in a completely separate pull request, because that way you can kind of completely decouple those changes. And it just makes it easier to review. It makes it easier to manage. And if you go back in your Git history in the future and you want to look at like what actually happened here, you don't have all of those kind of changes coupled together.
Yeah, especially if it's a file where you are actually changing some of the codes. I think it's completely pointless to do reformatting if you're not even touching a file in that pull request. But it's even worse if you are changing something and then there's like two lines of code that have been changed and the entire file is all like blue on GitHub or something, because every single line has had some change because of the whitespace changes. And then there are these critical two changes you've done that the reviewer is going to have to fish out of that sea of white space.
Exactly. And I also find it interesting. So now that we're talking about this here, we have mentioned many times now how we are kind of considering how the code will be reviewed as we're working on it, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because sometimes we work on projects that are, we just work on ourselves. Like when you work on AirBuddy, you don't have anyone reviewing that code, right? I mean, occasionally you send me some code, but I wouldn't call that a code review, right? Like that's just like asking for someone's opinion on something. But you know, when you work in a team, like I do, I work on many different projects that have teams. I would definitely always want to optimize the way I work for other people, like how they are going to review the code and how smooth and simple that's going to be. And I think if you do that, if you take that approach, even when you're working on your own, then it also usually leads to kind of better code or at least a more structured workflow, where if you are kind of more structured around those kinds of commits and making sure, like we mentioned, to not include like formatting in the same commit as a new feature, then that's just going to make the whole kind of Git history cleaner and easier to work with. It's going to make it easier to manage your own kind of releases and to know what you actually did change when you go back and compare version to version, for example. And also when you work in a team, that's going to be smoother for your coworkers. So I think taking that approach of thinking, how would someone else look at this change? Or how would someone else be able to review this change? I think that's just a generally good perspective to take.
Yeah, but also I review my own code, even though I don't have someone else on like a team doing that. I like to do it myself, and I've caught many things doing that. So before I actually push to my remote repo, I tend to do a git diff. Actually, these days I've been doing git diff tool, and I use the Kaleidoscope app on the Mac, which I think is fantastic for code review. So I do review my own code, and sometimes you do find some stuff that you've missed, maybe some print statement or even like something that may end up causing some bug. I have found a bunch of those things doing code review on my own code. So I think even if you are working just by yourself and you never plan on working on a team, at least you can review your own code a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. I do the same thing all the time before I send a pull request. And also when I work on my website, before I deploy it, I also look at the git diff of the actual HTML output. And I make sure that, you know, the right things were updated or I didn't cause any unwanted side effects if I was changing the source code for the generation of the website, for example. Also, like, I'm a big fan of using warnings. I think we've talked about that in the past, where yeah. As I'm working on something, I like to put like hashtag warning inside of my source code to remind myself of something I need to do in the future. And that could be something I want to do as part of the same commit. Like if I haven't yet figured something out when I'm refactoring some existing code, for example, I might put like a hashtag warning, figure this out in there. Or I think I sent you a screenshot of something where I had put like warning, this is probably wrong, right? And that's something that you definitely don't want to commit, right? So yeah. It's always great to just double check the code before you submit it, I think.
Yeah, I do that a lot as well. In fact, all of the warnings in the AirBuddy project at the moment are all to-dos. There are no like actual code warnings. They're all to-do. So it's just a bunch of stuff that I marked as a to-do item for probably this release cycle. So I keep it in there. And in this case, I actually commit it. But since it's just myself, it's not that big a deal. And yeah, I've even used the hashtag error when, like, let's say I have some appointment or something and I'm working on code and I know what I have to do next, but I won't be able to do it because I have to leave or there's something that I need to attend to. I put like hashtag error and then I describe what I have to do next and then I leave. And when I come back, there's this red message telling me what to do.
Yeah, I love that. That is a super good tip. And you can either do an error. You can also just like write a comment in the code as well, or just like put a text document or something in front of your code editor when you're, for example, wrapping up your work for the day. And then when you get to work again tomorrow, if you were in the middle of something, you kind of get that reminding message that says like, hey, you were actually just trying to do this or that. Because a lot of the times, at least for me, like when I start working in the day, it can take just a couple of minutes to kind of reorient myself as to what I was working on. So if I leave those kind of messages for myself in the future, that just helps a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So that's been my update for this week, like doing a bunch of refactoring, new features, finishing this big project. And yeah, feeling really great about that. And of course, I'm now excited to work on new projects. Nice. And what about you, Rambo? What have you been up to?
So we've been talking about the work I've been doing for AirBuddy 2.6, which I should be releasing fairly soon. And we talked about Swift UI stuff I've been doing. We're probably going to talk about Swift UI some more later. And one of the things is this new pop-up UI for keyboard shortcuts, where you invoke keyboard shortcuts in AirBuddy and it tells you with a little feedback heads-up display on top of the desktop what you've just done with a keyboard shortcut. And I was missing a particular keyboard shortcut action, which was to control spatial audio on the Mac. So since Monterey, macOS can do spatial audio with supported headsets like the AirPods Max, AirPods Pro, third generation AirPods, and some Beats headsets as well, and AirBuddy wasn't supporting any spatial audio, like you could connect to your AirPods with AirBuddy, but the app itself didn't have any facilities to toggle spatial audio, and you would have to use Control Center from macOS in order to do that. And the thing with AirBuddy is I like to expose system functionality in a way that allows people to do things in a more efficient manner. Like, there is no keyboard shortcut on macOS to toggle spatial audio. There is no such thing, and even there's no like shortcuts action from Apple that lets you change your spatial audio settings so that you could like create a shortcut and do it that way. So I went looking into that, which was quite challenging. I think it was probably one of the most challenging reverse engineering things I've done recently, because it's not... actually, there is like API, if you go looking in like AV Foundation and stuff, there is nice Objective-C turn spatial audio on, like APIs and things like that. But those APIs, they are high level and they are used by some system components, and they give you access to some stuff that I for some weird reason, Apple doesn't want third-party apps to access. So it's gated by entitlements, which basically prevents me from using those in AirBuddy. But I went looking and I found out that there are lower-level APIs that I could use to tell the system to toggle spatial audio on and off, to configure if head tracking is enabled or not, and also to check, like, is spatial audio currently available. So I'm currently in the process of integrating that into AirBuddy. I've released the beta last week that has that feature. And yeah, I'm quite happy that I managed to do that.
Yeah, it seems to have been a really like complex project to actually get all of this working and to figure all of that out. Because like you said, it's not just a matter of calling just one function. It's a matter of figuring out what functions that function calls and then calling those, right? And doing the right thing, yeah. And not ending up like setting the device in a strange state. And at the top of that, you've also been doing some really cool UI work, I think. And we can leave a link in the show notes to some of your tweets where you were demoing some of this, where it's always cool when I see your UIs, because I feel like you very often you go kind of above and beyond what would be required. Like, of course, the simplest thing would just be to do like a simple Boolean toggle, right? Like spatial audio on or off and call it a day. But you've done like these custom notifications that come in, and you can like as the user moves their head, if the head tracking is enabled, then the head on the notification moves and so on. Like there's just so many fun little details in the UI that you've made, I think.
Yeah, I'm working with Matthew Skiles, who's a great icon and UI designer, and he made the spatial audio icon for AirBuddy. And when we were working on that icon, we noticed that the way Apple represents spatial audio is they use the same icon for fixed and head-tracked mode. But in head-tracked mode, the icon is like skewed in a bit of a perspective to like give that impression that there's head movement. So we decided to go the same route, basically, and use the same icon. And I did different animations for that little pop-up that shows up, so that the fixed one, it just like the little waves show up. And for the head-tracked mode, the little waves show up and they kind of rotate in the y-axis in 3D. And I'm making air quotes here because it's not actually 3D. But then I thought, well, if I'm doing this and I know how to detect the head motion from the headset because I did that for the about window in Airbuddy, which was like a little fun Easter egg. How about I actually make the icon follow the user's head movement? So I did that for this little pop-up, which adds a little bit of a nice little extra fun to the UI.
Yeah, I think that's awesome because so many times when we talk about software development, like the conversations tend to be so much around efficiency, right? Like, how do we build this in the most efficient way? And we just had my topic, which is about like how to efficiently refactor things, right? Like how to get that into your workflow. And I feel like so many times when we're working on our projects, whether they are our own projects or they're projects for a client or working as part of a team or whatever, like so often it's just about like achieving that goal, achieving that very often like a minimum viable product, shipping that, and then like move on to the next MVP, right? Or move on to the next project. But I think it's so important, like at least every once in a while, to do these kind of fun things and add that kind of like delight into your UI, because I immediately noticed that when you shared it with me. And I think that really sets Airbuddy apart also from just the standard system UI. Not only that it provides you more utility that you can now use keyboard shortcuts and so on, but also like it's really fun. And I think that also has a ton of value. Of course, we can't spend our entire time just adding fun little animations like that, but I think also like it's important to do that every once in a while because it really, really like it shows that someone really cared about building this and it feels something that was like more kind of handcrafted, if you will. Like it has that nice personal touch that you don't get from so many UIs these days that are, you know, very kind of streamlined and consistent and sometimes a little bit boring, right? So it's really nice to see that you did this.
Yeah, and there are people who are not into that, and then that's totally fine. Just don't buy Airbuddy. if you don't want Airbuddy, don't buy it.
Right. If you don't want fun animations, don't buy it.
because there are some people who are not into that, and the app does follow like the reduced motion settings in macOS, and it even offers like its own option to speed up animations. And if you turn that on, then it will, like, instead of the window sliding down and slowly sliding back out, it will just fade in and out, which is basically how iOS and macOS handle reduced motion. Instead of doing these big moves, they just replace them by fades. And I think that's fine. So if someone doesn't like that much movement or they just want things to be as fast as possible, they can do that. And yeah, there's also something that I've noticed, especially in more power user people, not necessarily like developers or something, but I've noticed a trend of people like monitoring the CPU usage of things like to an unhealthy extent, in my opinion, because something that comes up sometimes when you do these delightful things is that people will say like, oh, but that's just wasting my CPU doing something that I don't want. Like, really? Like, it's going to use like 0.5% of CPU for 5 seconds. Is that really a problem? And I do get sometimes like, and to be completely clear, like if you're listening to this and you are an Airbuddy user and it's using 100% CPU in the background, that's wrong. Please report that and send a process sample, please. But like I do get like sometimes someone will ask like, oh, the background process has used 10 minutes of CPU time. And I'll be like, how long have you been running it? Oh, for 7 days. Like, 10 minutes of CPU time over 7 days?
Pretty good.
I think that's pretty good, yeah. Because, like, there is no free lunch, right? If the app is all the time scanning for Bluetooth Low Energy stuff, it will use CPU power to do that. There's no way around it.
Yeah, you want to use your computer to actually do computation, right? Like you want it to actually work. Of course, you don't want to be wasteful. And I kind of get also where these people are coming from, where Apple has also been removing some really useful information from the OS over the last couple of years when it comes to like battery estimations and so on, right? Like how long time you have left. And also with Apple Silicon, but also with Intel before that, like there was a lot of question around, you know, when I'm using my computer to run these apps, then my battery is 2 hours. But when I run these other apps, then my battery is 10 hours, because it all depends on the throttling and what you're actually using it for, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of get where these people are coming from, because, you know, if you are, for example, going on a trip, or if you are just working somewhere where you can't just plug in and charge all the time, like getting the most out of your battery can be really, really important. And then you don't want some silly animation kind of just eating up like 5% of your battery life or something. And also from the developer side, I think one thing that's really important to consider here is that, also to your point earlier, is that how long is this going to be appearing on the screen? For example, sometimes I see some apps that are running like a continuous animation, like all the time, like as part of the UI. And that's not great, because then you're invalidating that rendering context like all the time, on and on, like for minutes and minutes and hours and hours. So it's probably a good idea to kind of limit those things to just short animations. And if you do want something to like have some kind of movement or something in the UI, to maybe do that a little bit more periodically than doing it like all the time. Like, for example, if you have some screen that is showing if the user hasn't added some content to a group or a folder or something. Like sometimes people would add some cute animations there to like show, oh, there's nothing here yet. Like that's all good, but I would say play that animation for like a little while, a couple of seconds, then stop the animation, because you don't want to be constantly invalidating that layer so that it has to be redrawn by the system, because that is actually wasteful.
Yeah, and macOS does have some facilities where it will stop rendering windows that are covered up by other windows. So if the window is not visible, it's not actually rendering, basically. And I think that was back in Snow Leopard or something, that I remember they actually talked about it during the keynote, where they had the Safari window rendering something really expensive and then moved like a Finder window covering up all of the Safari window, and the CPU usage went way down because it wasn't rendering anymore. So you do get a lot of that for free on the Mac and of course on iOS as well. But I do see sometimes like where, if you have a menu bar app on the Mac, it's very common where you click the little icon and it shows a menu or a little window. And some apps will forget to like invalidate the window when it's no longer visible, or to just stop updating it. And that's something I did for everybody back when I made version 2, that I remember I forgot for like a couple of betas, and I realized that while the window was not visible, it was recalculating the list of devices and updating the list that's not on screen. So these days, I'm pretty sure that the actual window is completely released from memory when it's not visible. So those little things are really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's another thing that I think is very important to keep in mind, is that you want to do things... You want to strike a nice balance between having the data be available when the user needs it, so the user is not constantly just looking at a loading spinner like every time they try to do anything in the app. But also at the same time, you don't want to just be updating things that are no longer relevant or no longer needed, or the user might need it like 2 hours from now when that data will not be relevant anymore anyway. And those can be really tricky things to kind of decide. Like, do you load things up front or do you do it lazily when the user needs it? And usually I think it can be pretty good if you can to add a little bit of like smartness to that kind of logic, right? So for example, like if the user is navigating to a screen and then your analytics tells you that like 99% of users also then navigate to this other screen, then perhaps preloading that second screen is a good idea, because it will just make the flow more kind of smooth for most users. And then the 1% of users who don't navigate to that second screen, well, okay, that's actually wasted data, wasted computation, but that can be like a nice trade-off to make there. But on the other hand, if you just eagerly load too much, then that's again just going to be wasteful. So I think striking a nice balance there is usually really important.
Yeah, in my case, it was not that hard, because the actual data is always there. So it doesn't stop actually updating the data, because the data has to be there if you invoke a keyboard shortcut, for instance, to do something with a headset. It has to know which headset is connected and what's available and that sort of stuff. So the data is always there and it's always updating, but that process is not that expensive. But in terms of the list itself, so the actual ordering of devices on the list and actually creating the little controllers for each item and things like that, that's where it will stop updating when it's not visible. And You mentioned smarts. One of my favorite little things I did for the list of devices, which has been there since version 2, is something to prevent what I have been calling the banner effect, which is, so you know when you are on a website and you're about to click a link and then like an ad banner loads and you click the banner instead of the link
because
Yeah, the banner pushed the link down and then and that happens all the time on both the web and on iOS apps and Mac apps where you are about to click something and in the time your finger is traveling towards the trackpad or the mouse, something else loads and moves the thing you were going to click down and it's a disaster.
It happens all the time in Safari when you start typing something and then like the Siri suggestions, I think they call them, like they pop in like maybe a couple of milliseconds afterwards and then what you thought you were going to click on actually something else and then you end up on like Wikipedia or something when you just wanted to end up on your search engine.
Yeah, so that could happen in the list of devices because as you're interacting with the list, a new device could pop up or be updated or something. So I do have a little thing there where as you move the cursor on top of the list, it will prevent the list from being updated until the cursor has been still for a while or hasn't been moved over the list. So that's like, it's a very simple thing. And of course, you have to be careful with this sort of stuff, with race conditions. And like, you don't want to accidentally cause the list to lock up and never update anymore. So I did have to be careful with this implementation and actually tweaking like the timings, how long should the cursor be not moving for it to do its thing. But I did do that and it hasn't happened to me at least where I wanted to click something on that list and ended up clicking something else. And it was actually prompted because at some point while developing version 2, I was trying to click on like a pair of AirPods, but I accidentally clicked another device and it did something and it was irritating. So I call it the banner effect. I don't know if it has an actual name, but everyone feel free to call that the banner effect.
Effect. Yeah, I love that. That's a very, very good term for it. I haven't come up with a name myself for it. I just call it the annoying effect, I guess. But I will call it the banner effect from now on.
Awesome.
So there was something I wanted to ask you going back to spatial audio that you've just, you know, been working on. So in AirBuddy right now, you have many different features and they have to interact with the system or with the devices that you're controlling with AirBuddy in many different ways. Like, you're sometimes constructing like Bluetooth messages yourself, I know. Sometimes you have some API you can call from the system. Sometimes it's a private API. Sometimes it's something you have to go to a lower level. So I can imagine that you have like quite a lot of different kind of code paths and you have a lot of different ways to interact with the devices and the system in the app. So I wanted to first ask you, like, how are you in general kind of structuring that? Because I think a lot of projects have similar challenges where they might need to interact with many different services. Maybe you have to call like a bunch of different SDKs, or you have to call a bunch of different web APIs or something to load your data or to perform different actions. And how are you kind of thinking about that also in terms of maintenance? Like, if Apple will change some of these things, like how are you kind of trying to prepare the code base for being iterated on in that way?
Yeah, so recently, and I think we mentioned this, one of the things I did was to completely redo the whole Bluetooth Classic implementation in AirBuddy. So the thing that does like the quote old Bluetooth things, talking to like mice and keyboards and doing the actual audio level connection to headsets and things like that, which is all Bluetooth Classic. And I had to do that because Apple changed the Bluetooth implementation on macOS to basically be the same as it is on iOS. Of course, not exactly the same, but the Bluetooth stacks have pretty much aligned as of, I think it was Monterey 12.2, where things converged pretty much completely. So iOS and macOS now have a very similar Bluetooth stack, which of course is great for Apple because they don't have to worry about those differences. And it's also, in a sense, great for developers who make iOS apps because if they want to have an iOS app on the Mac that does Bluetooth, they don't have to worry too much about weird inconsistencies. But what happened was I would have to use a different implementation for Monterey and for older OSs, so anything before Monterey. And I basically re-implemented my whole Bluetooth Classic layer. And the way it works is I have, so I use XPC a lot, so cross-process communication a lot on AirBuddy, and I do that in order to isolate some more, quote, dangerous stuff from the main app. And one of those things that's isolated is the Bluetooth Classic stuff. So it has an XPC interface where the main app can call stuff to like get updates when new classic devices appear. So like when a new mouse or keyboard is connected and that sort of stuff. And the actual underlying implementation is using a protocol. So the actual protocol I called BT Classic Integration. So I have a protocol that does the bridging from my classic Bluetooth Classic API into whatever the underlying system API is. So if the next version of macOS needs a completely different Bluetooth Classic implementation, which I hope it doesn't, I can write a new thing that implements this integration protocol and just tell this service to use that integration on macOS 13, I guess, and it will, quote, just work. So basically, the gist of it is that I try to abstract that sort of stuff as much as possible, because you don't want to, like in your UI code, have to worry about, or is this using Monterey or is this the Big Sur thing? Yeah, that would be terrible. So I, as much as possible, try to keep everything very well abstracted. And whenever I'm talking to private API, I always do a bunch of safety checks in order to make sure that if that API goes away or if it breaks or something like that, that I don't just crash, which has happened fairly recently, actually, because there was some old code where I wasn't doing all of those checks. But I've learned, so I've been very careful with doing lots and lots of checking to make sure that, because it's basically untrusted data. It's kind of like when you're writing a web API and you can't trust what's coming in and it can like do SQL injection or something. It's kind of like that, where I can't trust that this private API is going to keep giving me a string in a future macOS release. It probably will, but it might not. So I do like a lot and lots of checking of things and try to fall back to sensible failure modes and defaults if something breaks in the future. Which, of course, like I'm always on top of things. I'm always running the latest beta of macOS. So if something breaks, I will know, and an updated version of the app will be out probably by the time that update is out. So I can always keep fixing stuff, but I try to abstract things as much as possible.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good. And what you were describing there is kind of like the perfect way, I think, of using protocol-oriented programming, right? And I think it's the reason why protocol-oriented programming became so popular when it first, like when people first started talking about it, where especially if you're interacting with anything that has to do with like the system or sensors, like the camera or the accelerometer or location services or whatever, like it's usually a good idea to abstract that somehow. And a protocol can be a very good approach there in those kinds of situations where you can have multiple implementations. It can be one for production, one for testing. It can be one for a new version of the operating system, one for the previous version. Or in your case, it can also be like different services that feed into the UI and so on. So that, I think, is usually a very, very good thing. And, you know, even though protocol-oriented programming, like as people thought about it a few years ago, perhaps isn't as popular these days, because what did end up happening in many code bases is that people just took it too far, right? And there was just like a protocol for every class and a protocol for everything. And all of a sudden things become really complicated. But I think like these is one of those things where I personally also still always want to use a protocol, because I just want that layer between my own code and the code that I'm depending on. And the same thing goes when I'm introducing like third-party SDKs for things like, you know, it can be for things like analytics or it can be for anything else, where I just want to make sure that if that dependency will need to be replaced in the future. I don't need to go through and update the entire code base. And also, when I'm writing my tests, I can also mock that out, so I don't have to, you know, use the real SDK in kind of my testing as well. And the same thing goes for networking and many other things that I like to still use protocols for.
Yeah. One of my favorite abstractions that I've made over the years is this AC Bluetooth address type that I made for everybody, where it is related to using a bunch of these different APIs, where each API represents MAC addresses, so Bluetooth MAC addresses in a certain way. So some of them will use lowercase letters and dashes to separate each byte. Some will use colons to separate the bytes. Some will use actually data blobs, so data or NS data. And I was having a bunch of issues where I was having to convert between different representation of a Bluetooth address, and I would have bugs where I was trying to look up something by Bluetooth address and it was using the dash separator, but I had the address in the colon separator style. So I wrote this type that it can be initialized with any supported representation. So the string with any type of separator or the data blob, and it can just give me whatever representation I need. And it does the hashable and equatable stuff. So it doesn't matter what representation the address comes in. I can always just wrap it in this AC Bluetooth address thing, and it will just do the right thing for me. And it also actually like caches the different representations in order to not be doing like the string manipulation and data creation all the time for every little Bluetooth address that appears in the app. So this was also something that I did, and it's working on unifying a bunch of stuff that comes from different places that might not be directly compatible. And by abstracting this with this little type that I made, I can avoid having to worry about that.
Yeah, that sounds really, really good. I had a very similar situation in one of my projects as well, where I was working with a bunch of objects that had different IDs, and the different like systems that I was working with, they wanted these IDs to be like represented in different ways. Like some of them wanted it to be just uppercase, and some of them wanted it to be lowercase, and so on. So I made this property wrapper that I called like normalized ID, and then I can just do like at normalized ID in front of that property, and then it would do it during the decoding. It would normalize it, and then when I would send it to these different services, I could then choose like what formatting do I want, and it can just happen like automatically. So I wouldn't have to worry about that at every single call site. So like the normalization would kind of happen under the hood. And yeah, it's very similar to what you just described. Like, I think it's nice to solve these things kind of on the type system level, either using a property wrapper or using a dedicated type or something, where you are then like you're getting that guarantee where if you are dealing with this wrapper type, then you are going to always have the data be in the format that is correct for this particular context.
Yeah, definitely. And something that I also use quite a bit when dealing with these APIs that might not have the assumptions that I have about them. Like sometimes you assume that this thing is always going to return a particular type of thing, or it's never going to be nil or something. But sometimes that assumption is wrong. So whenever I have one of those assumptions, I use the assert keyword or method or macro or whatever. So I put assert or NS assert. And then if during my local development and testing, one of those assumptions is proven wrong, I'll have a nice crash in front of me telling me exactly what happened.
Yeah, I think assertions is something that is in general very kind of underutilized, where one important thing about assertions is that they're basically for free in production, where they use like this auto closure feature of Swift, where if you're running in production, like without assertions enabled for a release build, then the expression in the assertion won't even be evaluated. So your assertion is basically completely free. It doesn't have any cost with it when you're running in production, but you can use it to like cause a crash in development, which is like so incredibly useful. I use it also all the time, and I'm adding new assertions all the time to my projects where, like you say, if you're making some assumption that you can't really find a good way to encode like into the type system, because, well, you can't encode everything into the type system, right? Like, we need something to happen at runtime as well. And like a classic thing is like you're passing an array to something and you want to be able to assume that that array is non-empty. Well, you can just like add an assertion, which is just checking like the array is not empty. And then during development, if the array is never empty, then you have pretty good confidence that it won't be in production either. And of course, you could then go even further and you could make like a non-empty array type or something, but that's not always worth it when it comes to these things. Like, sometimes it's not worth adding additional types, adding additional like structure and abstractions. Sometimes you just want that little check, and you might not want to crash in production, like make a hard crash using fatal error or something, because it might not be that important. So then an assertion is just perfect, because it, like, again, asserts that your assumption is correct during development, and you can still run that in a way that is just completely ignored in production.
Yeah, definitely. I was having a look at the documentation here, so it looks like for Swift, it doesn't actually remove, because I'm pretty sure that the NS assert one that I use in Objective-C code, I think that's not even compiled in when it's in release mode, but with the Swift one, it's just like you mentioned, if you have the dash O optimization option, which is the default for the release configuration, then it's not going to evaluate the condition.
Yeah, exactly. So perhaps it's not 100% for free. It's like one function call and then it immediately returns, but I think we can call that for free, right? It's like probably like one processor instruction or something.
But I guess it's inlined, right? So it's not going to make a difference.
Then it will be fine. I think that's not going to be a performance bottleneck in your project. I think we can say that with a very high degree of confidence.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So I think this has been a really interesting episode of Stack Trace, talking about our projects and, of course, our learnings from them. And this is something that I think we're just going to keep doing going forward, is that, you know, we want to structure the show a lot around like what we're working on, but not just talk about what we've been working on, but also like what we've learned from it, and, you know, try to like discuss the wider aspects of it as well. And I think this was a good example of that, if I may say so myself. I think this episode was a lot of fun discussion. So what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree.
So we will be back again in May for our first May episode, and we'll see what's going to happen until then. Maybe we'll have some WWDC speculations coming up and so on, because, well, it's getting closer to this year's edition of the conference. And of course, if you have any feedback or any questions you want to ask us, you're always more than welcome to contact us. You can reach us both via email at ask@stacktracepodcast.fm, or you can reach out via Twitter, either using the show's handle itself, using @StackTracePod, or by contacting me @JohnSundell or Mr. Rambo @_inside. But that's it for this episode. So thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you again soon. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.